listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is, December 23rd. We're recording this in November, but a very Merry Christmas to everybody who's listening in right now. Merry Christmas, Scott.
Hey, sleigh bells. Yeah, all that stuff.
Sleigh bells and all that stuff. We are having a potluck today. We are sponsored by two awesome companies. First one is FreshBooks. Second one is Sentry. Talk about both of them partway through the episode. But we got a bunch of really awesome questions for you today, and we're gonna rip through them. So, Scott, you want to start off with the first question here?
Hey, first question is from Rock Tolinsky. He says, "You guys are doing a downtown job," with 3 exclamation points. That is straight up from my dad. So shout out to my dad, who may or may not be listening to this, but he did watch our 200th episode or a 300th episode. And he had never heard of Discord. So he's just like, well, I'll just submit a thing on the potluck and maybe they'll see it. So thanks, Dad, for being so supportive.
My dad said he was going to try call in as well, but then he got busy. We should have both of our dads on at some time, or just like let them and then yes, we'll walk away.
You would want that. My dad is a riot. He is very funny.
Really?
Yes. He's a character in the best, all of the best possible ways. He's very funny. Yeah.
All right. Let's get into some questions here. We got actually two questions about computers. Well, I thought we'd start that off because I don't know, like maybe like a month or two ago, we got questions about the new Apple Silicon Macs. And I was saying like, oh, it'll be years before it's out, but before we move over. And I was super wrong about that. They came out like a month after or 2 months after we had talked about it. It's looking like they're moving pretty quickly. So we thought we got a question here about them. And we thought we'd sort of tackle them as to, are they viable machines for web devs? So the question is from Pookie. Hey, guys. Wes, thanks for all Pookie. Your courses. I am a longtime listener. Your rec courses helped me land a new job last month for a sweet raise. Oh, congratulations, yeah. Pookie. Yesterday, Apple announced their new Macs. They seem pretty sweet, but I was curious as what does this mean for the world of web developers? Will my current apps slowly stop being supported? Will things like Brew and Node and NPM still work on the new machines? Would it be smart to start learning new programs to prepare for the transition? Love the show. Have a great day. All right. I thought this was really cool because Apple released them. It seems like a lot of the stuff that we do as creators, video editing, audio, also just like running processes, we haven't really seen like what does Node look like because it's not supported yet, but very, very excited about it. What about you, Scott? Are you looking at these new ones?
I'm sort of in the same camp I was with other things where it's just like wait and see at this point, because like I just bought a 16-inch MacBook Pro and it is a beast and it does all the things I need it to do. So I'm not like itching for a bubbly. Well, okay, I shouldn't say that. I would love a new computer. I always love a new computer, but at this particular juncture, I am just like not even concerning myself with them. I have like done next to zero research about them beyond the fact that it go fast, and I'm pretty pumped about that for the future. I have it in my mind. I saw a report about a Mac Pro, not a Mac Pro Mini, but a quote unquote smaller sized Mac Pro. And I'm thinking that would be really sick to have like just sitting behind my monitor, right? Something little behind my monitor or even like a true audio setup and have it in another like cooled closet or something like that. And run some cables. You know what? I don't know personally. I'm not interested in any of these other ones, but I would be interested. Like if they are really that fast, then maybe getting like a production machine and like maybe having that be a thing. But who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, I think that these new ones are probably not for us as like video and content creators. I bet that they'll come out with like, they'll take like 7 of the chips and throw them in another one. That's amazing. Yeah. I think that will be the one for us. But for web developers, they seem pretty attractive. So the question is, do I need to, like, what about my software? Is it going to work for web developers or do I need to pick up new stuff? So the answer is probably not.
Yeah.
It looks like most of the software either will already work in sort of like a VM, or would they plan to make it work at some point? So I thought it would be kind of interesting to go through the list of software that we use as web developers and just give a quick yes, no, or it's coming. And again, we're recording this a month in advance. So a lot of the being worked on might even be it works already. So there's a couple good websites you can go to. Is AppleSiliconReady.com. And then there is a GitHub repo called Does It ARM? So ARM is the technology that is the, underneath the Apple Silicon. Apparently, it's not exactly the same thing, but a lot of the tech that where it already works with ARM, because there's a lot of tablets and phones that are built on ARM that already support the software. So let's the big thing is Electron-based apps. So apps that are built in JavaScript, HTML, CSS, but are desktop apps like VS Code, Notion, Missive,
Discord.
Is Slack Electron-based still?
I actually don't know if Discord is, but I think it is. I know it's web-based.
It's so definitely Discord. Yeah, it's definitely web-based. So all of those things, it looks like Electron has already rolled out a blog post saying Electron 11 will start to ship a x64 version of it. So all of these apps should work. The sort of only gotcha is when these apps have like native dependencies under the hood that need to be ported over. I think the next big one is Brew. So Brew is the command line utility that you use to install a lot of the things. And that currently does not work natively. It does work under Rosetta 2. So you can run a lot of these applications under Rosetta 2 and they will run. And it looks like they already have a path forward to trying to port it over to Apple Silicon, which is pretty cool.
And from what I hear, if you're running web dev stuff in Rosetta, the speeds are pretty comparable to what it was without Rosetta, as in what it would be on a standard Intel older Mac.
Just a regular Intel Mac. So that's good, because then like all of the new stuff will hopefully be faster, and then the Rosetta stuff will be just as good as you had it. Chrome, and by extension, I'm assuming Brave and IE are already on Apple Silicon. Firefox will be soon. As of recording, it's not. VS Code is Insider's build will run, yes, soon. ScreenFlow, that's a big one for me. That's my main recording tool. There's no Rosetta 2 or native.
Oh, it doesn't work with Rosetta 2.
No, it doesn't even. So like those apps that are like very heavy on video processing, they use a lot under the hood. They already said that they've been working on the developer kit all summer. So it's not like it got released and they're like, oh, maybe we should update it. Like they have been working on it. So that's the one I'm really excited for, because my biggest pain points with my laptop are slow video export times and bad battery life when you're running node processes. I hope the export, like even if it gets like twice as fast, some people are saying like 5 or 6 times faster video exports, which I have a hard time believing, but like, man, will I lay down money quick.
Yeah.
If that happens.
Well, just think about all the time loss that you have from your, and that's why I think about like a production machine. If I had like a Mac Pro production machine, you could just tell that go thing to export, 30 videos and then pop over to your laptop or something. And
what else do we have here? Figma, unsure. It's browser based. So yes. I would assume it would work because it's all web tech, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't find anything online. Sketch is already updated to Apple Silicon, so you get big benefits there. I couldn't find any info on MongoDB.
DaVinci Resolve is fully supported.
Wow. Oh, that's good. I would be very curious to see what the exports on DaVinci Resolve look like.
Yeah, me too.
How much faster they would be. iTerm 2 is being worked on. I'm assuming Hyper is Electron, so probably. And those are all the big ones that I'm using. Oh, the other one is Node. Node does not work. NPM and Node does not work yet.
Same with Rust.
I'm assuming it will work eventually. And then they have announced that they will backport some of the, I think Node 15 will work on this, but they'll backport like some of the LTS releases. That will probably be an issue unless, that's the other one, is Docker. Docker does not currently work on it. And that's a massive one for web developers, because if you need to run any tools in a Docker container, even like you want to run an old version of Node that doesn't work on Apple Silicon, you think, I'll just run it in a VM.
Uh-huh.
But if the VM doesn't run, then you're kind of out of luck. So Node and Docker, probably I would hold off as a web developer for those ones, because those are huge ones and large part of our tooling. Even if you don't I don't use Docker directly, a lot of the tooling you're using does use Docker under the hood.
Yeah. For me, I'm in a firmly wait and see mode with any of this stuff, which is very contrasting to how I am with software. When I like Big Sur, okay, Alpha, let's go. On my, you know, livelihood machine, let's go. So for me, it's funny that I do take a bit reserved approach with this stuff. But then again, I'm not needing a new computer, so I'm kind of checked out of that hunt anyways. But it's fascinating to see the updates, and we'll see exactly what this does to the industry and if this shakes it up at all. All right, next question is from Christos Altas. Hey, great show. No, really, great show. What is better for working at the home or office, an iMac or a MacBook Pro? Ooh. Yeah, it really depends on some things. Like if you don't have an external monitor, having that big old iMac screen is really pretty sick. One time when I worked at one of my first agencies, I was given a large iMac as my like dev machine, and I really loved it. I really loved having that thing. But before, I was just used to only working on laptops. So I don't know. The big monitor is a big plus if it's your only screen. That said, I am the type to always have my computer with me or want to bang out some code or something. So I prefer a MacBook Pro personally and almost would always have that as my default main machine.
Yeah, I agree. I put this in here because this question I get all the time. Like, why don't you buy a Mac Pro and then also have a laptop? Or why don't you buy an iMac and also have a laptop or have a dedicated machine for recording and then another one? I'm like, I don't want the overhead of maintaining two machines. And I 100% need to be able to take my work with me to a coffee shop or to a conference or whatever. And I just need everything with me. And I don't want to have to fuss with two different ones. So because of that, I bought the most powerful MacBook Pro that you can get.
Yep.
And
souped it up.
It sounds like a rocket ship all the time because I'm pushing it to its limits a lot of the time. I have it hooked up to two 4K monitors, it running a dock, running all of my stuff. And it works. It works great. So I'm a big fan of buy the MacBook Pro and then also invest in desktop stuff. And it's funny, my battery died on me once on my MacBook Pro, and the lady's like, don't leave it plugged in all the time. I'm like, what? I'm supposed to have it plugged in. I use it all day.
They always have something to say for how you like, if it's never the machine's fault or the tech's fault. Like
it wrong.
Yeah, my power cord literally caught on fire. The power cord caught on fire. And they're like, well, you shouldn't wrap it around the hooks. Like, the hooks exist for you to wrap it around.
Yeah, why are
you
made the hooks there?
And then they took the hooks off, probably because it was happening to a lot of people. But like, come on, man, my thing just caught on fire. Have some empathy here. I agree with you. And I also ran two machines myself once before. I had a Hackintosh for a long time. People always ask me, well, I've been there, done that for a very long time. I know all the ins and outs of the Hackintosh ecosystem. And it was a giant pain in the ass to have two computers. It definitely was. Now, I say that as somebody who will jump back in and maybe get a Mac Pro when these things, you know, get into the ARM territory. But we'll see about that. I think all the syncing libraries and everything might make that a little bit easier now with like Apple syncing all of your everything in Dropbox or Google Drive or whatever. All right. Next question here is from Liz. Liz says, hi, Scott and Wes. Thanks for all of the content on your podcast. I was wondering two things. What are your thoughts on Remix? And has your listenership gone down since COVID-19? I've heard that less people are listening to podcasts now because they can no longer have a commute. Thanks for all that you do. Yeah, you know, I haven't checked the listener stats recently, but definitely in March, we saw a big hit. I think things have normalized a little bit, but I don't think they're back to where they were because, most people aren't, maybe not most people, but there are a large amount of people who are tech people who are now at home. And some people can't listen to podcasts while they code or while they do other things. And I listen to them in the gym while I'm doing dishes. I've actually have not personally decreased my listenership of podcasts, but I know a lot of people have. Wes, do you have the stats or?
Yeah, I have them open right now. And it's probably like a 10-15% drop. Not as much as I was expecting, because a large portion of the listenership does listen on a commute. Mm-hmm. Definitely saw like a big drop around April. Not a huge drop, but it definitely a drop.
Definitely a drop.
And it rebounded after that. We're still not at all-time highs that we were last year around September. But also the other thing is that this podcast continues to grow listenerships as well. So that probably has something to do with the fact that we just keep getting more listeners that are new and finding out about the show. That sort of replaces some of the people that are not necessarily driving 45 minutes to and from their job every single day. So
yeah.
Pleasantly surprised, given that it seems like all podcasts have taken a bit of a dive lately.
So what you're saying is that we would have seen a dip, but we're just too popular.
Just way too popular, yeah.
Yes.
The other question is here, your thoughts on Remix. So Remix. If you haven't heard, Remix is a new React framework from
Michael Johnson,
Ryan Florence, and Michael Jackson. Michael Johnson. Yes. And they're the devs behind React Router 1 through 49. And yes. Just joking. Every time we mention React Router, we joke around about that. It's a new React framework that is, it looks like they are rivaling Next.js, not in that they are going to go toe-to-toe competing with features and doing the same thing, but they are doing a sort of approaching it a little bit differently, including the fact that it's not open source. You have to pay to get access to it. And they are, which is really cool because like these guys have spent their lives building and maintaining React Router and a couple other popular projects.
Stuff that's probably used by millions of people and haven't seen a dime for it, you know?
Yeah. And also, like, not even that they didn't see a dime, but they, like, get flack from people like Scott and I when they upgrade and a new version of React Router.
I am firmly in the camp of, I love all of their updates. React Router is one of those projects that you do no wrong, and I love React Router. So don't get that wrong impression, because I really do love all of their updates. In fact, some of the React Router stuff is like features that I must have that they've introduced recently.
So like, I don't really know a whole lot about it because I haven't paid for it. And we asked Ryan to come on the show. Maybe we should ask him again to sort of explain it. But one of the features that I see just from the Twitter sphere is that it will work entirely just server side. And you can run it without actually having React on the on the client, which is pretty nifty.
And I think that might be a primary drive of a lot of it is letting the server do more, and not just like in a server side rendering situation, but like a caching and sending React components down the line.
Yeah. I'm really excited about it. I don't think that it's not going to replace Next.js in terms of popularity. And I don't think that's what they're aiming for. They are probably aiming for like a license for a team license is $1,000 per dev per year, which if somebody's building a massive application on it, that's not really necessarily a big expense for them when they're probably paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in salaries every single month. So it's really interesting. I'm kind of excited about this different approach that they are taking to it. A lot of people are saying like, oh, it's paid, it will never take off. But I think that they've thought a lot about it, and it's going to be a pretty nifty little framework.
Yeah. And I don't know if we've talked about this before, but I don't know if you ever used Expression Engine before, but that was a paid CMS framework that did pretty well. And it was a nice experience to use. And as a developer, I always was, you know, happy when our company got a license for it. So I think there is a market for this type of thing. And I'm excited to see where it goes, because they understand, like many other people understand right now, that the process of server-side rendering and then hydrating and all that stuff is way harder than it needs to be, especially if you've done any of it outside of the context of a Next.js app or something that does it for you.
Yeah. One more thing I have here. We need to have a show on open source sustainability, because I was talking to Jed, who works on Keystone. And he's got a lot of thoughts about that as well, because like he has a consulting business and then he also has this Keystone JS, which is a big open source project. And I'm just like telling him, like, I will pay, I don't know, $200. Like, I always go back to paying for advanced custom fields on WordPress, where I paid the $100 or $200 for the plugin, and I get this amazing gallery plugin that is like a custom, a really good field that I add to it. And I'm keep telling him, like, I'll pay for that for Keystone, where you have a sweet gallery, you can drag and drop, reorder, add alt text, crop, image face detection, all of that added to it. I think there's some really neat stuff that could be done with open source and premium plugins, or just going entirely paid like Remix is doing. I think it's an interesting space. Next question from New York Dame. What is your approach for testing e-commerce sites? I'm about to launch a client's online store, and I'm sick with worry that a simple plugin upgrade will impact the store and that I won't know about it until a disgruntled customer complains. Ooh, this is a good one. Like, and this is kind of scary because this is the moneymaker, right? It's not like, oh, this button got like a weird hover color or something like that. It's like literally they're not, the money stopped coming in for the business. How do you test it? Well, there's sort of like a lot of ways you can go at it. And I recommend as many ways as possible. I'll tell you what I do currently. And I'm working on doing like an automated test for it, but I currently don't. So whenever I even touch a piece of code that has to do with the checkout or even the CSS of the checkout, because I've done it in the past where the buy button wasn't visible because I changed the font size of something. So usually what I'll do is you can get test Stripe keys. You can just run that locally on your machine. You can 424242, the credit card is a fake number, and you can get credit cards that will reject. You can get different credit cards that will reject for different reasons, and you can test them all to make sure that both your error handling is working as well as the actual checkout is working and the fulfillment on that. And then anytime anything changes in your code, you can rerun it. And the question here is like a plugin upgrade. It's probably WordPress. And the fact that WordPress lets you upgrade plugins in production is like, it's good because like a lot of people don't even have a development environment for WordPress, but you should definitely have some sort of development environment where you're just in Stripe keys. You don't accidentally send emails to customers. You're totally isolated from it. Past that, like there's nothing wrong with, sometimes I'll do this. I get emails from people all the time being like, hey, I can't buy it. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, is there something wrong with my checkout system? And at the end of the day, there's something wrong with their credit card or whatever, and they weren't reading the error right. But I'll just generate a coupon that gives me like 99.9% off. It just brings it down to 50 cents or something like that. And I'll use my actual credit card to check it out. And it does cost me 40 or 50 cents, but there's something to say for that peace of mind every now and then, just to double check that it is working in production as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on Braintree, which has a little bit different of a way. It's the same deal with the test credit cards, and there's a sandbox environment. And we do have automated testing. At the end of the day, I think what this user needs is a local environment to be able to install, test it out, make sure it's going to work. And then if you want to do that YOLO on production after that, then by all means, go ahead. But again, it depends on how much money is this store making you? Is this your whole livelihood and you're neglecting these things? Is store making you a ton of money, or is it just like extra side income? And to me, that the amount of money that the store is making really will change what my testing procedures around this looks like, because if this is my entire livelihood and it is a lot of money coming in, then I'm going to make sure I have automated testing in place. I'm going to make sure I have that local dev environment. I'm going to make sure I have everything set up to prevent any loss of funds. Oh, and Wes has a, Wes is giving me a transition into our sponsor. His transition is not good. Okay, so let me do a touch up here.
Give me something better.
The one Wes gave me is, you know what else handles money? Okay, fine. But you could have said, let's say the site is bringing you in lots of money and all of a sudden you need to start tracking that money. It's the same premise, Wes, but what you've done is you've bridged the gap, but you haven't told a story. So that's really what you have to do. You have to tell a story. And if you want to make money on those stories, you can always sell your stories on your e-commerce site and keep track of that payment with FreshBooks.
Yes, FreshBooks is small business accounting. You do your invoices, you can manage all your clients, you can see who owes you money, you can automatically follow up with them with the robot. It's awesome. It's the best software I've ever used to manage all of your company's expenses, invoices, all that stuff. And I just want to tell a really quick story. I think I told this on a couple episodes ago, but I'm going to tell it again. I had an issue with one of the reports that I was generating in FreshBooks. And I said, this is not working. I clicked the button and it didn't work. And so I called him up, first ring, picked up. He said, oh man, we can get it. We get that sorted for you. So the guy on the phone manually generated them for me and sent them over an email so I could get them off to my accountant and that'd be good. And then they went off and logged the bug and followed it up with their product team. And 2 days later, I got an email from them saying, hey, thanks so much. This was actually affecting a couple other clients as well. We fixed it and here it is. And it was awesome. I didn't have to chase them around. They told me when it was ready. They fixed the issue temporarily for me. So just outstanding customer service at FreshBooks as well. So check it out, freshbooks.com/syntax for a 30-day free trial. And make sure you use syntax in the how did you hear about us section, because that will keep them sponsoring on and on. Thanks so much to FreshBooks for sponsoring.
Cool. Next question from Corbin. Hey, Syntax boys. I'm getting into web development through college and noticing that the intro courses are very hard to get into. I've been self-teaching, so I'm feeling like I'm ahead. The intro to computing logic course, basic algorithm teacher, very slowly forces us to use an awful software called Raptor to create pseudo programs. I've been asking to actually use a language rather than software, but the teacher doesn't have enough programming knowledge to grade actual language assignments. I feel like this course is a step back from what I already know, and I was just wondering if you have any tips on getting through the grueling required courses. Love the podcast. Can't wait to hear more. Okay, so I took a number of classes that I did not care for or that were behind me. I took a I took a web design and development course at the art school of the University of Michigan where they used, oh gosh, what was the software? It was Adobe Go Live. I forget what it's called. It was Adobe's version of Dreamweaver before Dreamweaver existed. It was all based on dragging and dropping things onto a grid. You could do multiple layers and it never worked in the code. It always worked in their little preview browser, but it never worked in any real browser. So it was total garbage. And I coded everything by hand throughout the whole course because why? Well, because you don't get to have control over the assignments. I recommend finding some way, any way, that you can make your assignments more exciting or interesting for you to keep you engaged, because that's really what's going to come out of this. You're going to get the most out of this if you can use at least some inspiration from what they're doing to drive you forward in some sort of way. So I think that's an important concept, is you need to keep yourself engaged if the course is not keeping you engaged. Like I had classes that were like music history that I did really poorly in, but I, to get through them, what I would do would be writing computer programs to help me study, you know, it's like trying to find some way, any way to make it engaging. So if you're getting bored with the programs that they're having you write or any of that stuff, I still think you can find some way to make it more interesting to you. Like what if, for instance, what if instead of just doing the assignment in Raptor, what if you did it in a programming language first and then did it in Raptor? It's like, okay, I guess that's double work, but at least you're getting something out of it. I don't know. I would again make sure you're getting the lessons that the teacher is actually teaching and not just like what you think they're teaching, and pay attention as much as you can and take to learn the heart of the core concepts and fundamentals to the best you possibly can, and it should help you along.
I just looked up what this Raptor was, and it's like a flowchart diagramming tool, and I literally wrote so many flowchart diagramming tools in school, and they were not for programming per se. They were more business processes and like swim lanes and things like that for like how you would do order fulfillment and whatnot. It was like, it was related to tech, but it had nothing to do with actually writing any code. It's funny because this Raptor, the screenshot is from Windows XP. So I can just feel how like, ooh, this software must be to actually use. And I remember when I was doing these, I just remember being like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, why am I swim flow charting arrows to everything? I just remember being like, I have no idea. And it was because these teachers think like, yeah, you got to focus on the fundamentals. You got to learn this stuff first before you actually write any code. And we've talked about this before. And the reality is that maybe you don't necessarily have to spend your entire day on the fundamentals. And maybe you can jump in and start trying to write some stuff. It might not be good. It might not be the best stuff ever, but at least you're getting your feet wet. So that sucks for you that you have to do that. And yes, like, what are the tips for getting through this grueling required work? Just do them. Like, you don't have to like slam dunk them. I got 70s all through university because I was just putting in the work that was needed to get through it. And like, I look back in hindsight, and when I did learn things, I look back and go, oh, that's what that swim chart was. That's what the these ideas were. And I did look back and go, oh, I understand now that I know these things. I look back at it and maybe I did learn a thing or two. So definitely put in a little bit of time and get those done. But like what I really want to say here is that if you want to get good at programming, it's all about what you do and how you put in the time. So take this time that you have in school, start taking online courses or building a side project, or you're obviously listening to this podcast. So that's getting you somewhere as well.
Just keep listening to the podcast.
Keep listening to the podcast. Keep building things, because when you get out of school, your career and what job you get is not going to be based on what grade or how many diagrams you built. It's going to be what can you actually build and what have you built in the past and what are you familiar with in terms of real world technology. So that's my advice there.
You mean to tell me, Wes, that my D in music history did not impact my career overall as a web developer?
Yes, it's, I don't know, it's funny. Like, I don't want to like poo-poo traditional school so much, because like there's a lot of good stuff that can come with that. But we get a lot of these questions where people say like, hey, like what you guys who are real web developers are talking about and what they're teaching me in school have almost no overlap. And it's frustrating to see, because I don't know, it's hard. I have also gotten emails from people who do teach in schools and are very much up on how it works.
Word.
Next question from Randy. So it's been announced that Sapper will never hit 1.0. Instead, Svelte Core's functionality is being expanded and Sapper is going to be deprecated. Oh, so the functionality of Sapper is going to be rolled into what Svelte is. I know you all don't have any inside info on this, but kind of wondering how Scott feels about this and what he's doing with his Sapper site in the nebulous time between the big announcement and the release of the next Svelte version. I'll really quickly just say what I say thinking about this. I love this. I wish that React would do more. I wish that there was more rolled into what React does. There's something about the JavaScript industry where we have to pick and choose our pieces. And often that's why people love Next.js, is that Next.js doesn't even do half the stuff you want it to do, because they say, go grab external packages for it. But I wish that more JavaScript frameworks would do more like they're doing here.
Yeah, because when you control more, you control more of the output, right? I've gotten the vibe with, I don't know how much, I know you've been doing a little bit at Dino. We should do like a Dino episode now.
Yeah.
I don't know how much you've been doing with it to the point where you've noticed some of this, but I've really noticed that one thing I love about the Dino infrastructure and community overall is that a lot of the stuff like linting and formatting and all that stuff and testing is like baked in, which is just like, it's such a relief not to have to like, oh, what library am I going to use for this? And does Megalord connect to Omega Star and whatever? Does Omega Star connect to the Big Brain? I mean, honestly, all those connections is like where things start to become a problem. So what am I going to do with my Sapper site? I am not going to do a gosh darn thing with it, at least not for right now, because really what they've said is that the Svelte kit, which is what they're going to be calling it, is basically going to have the functionality of Sapper. So it's going to have at least some sort of file-based routing system, as far as I know. Like if it has file-based routing system, and maybe some things will be different. I have no idea. My Sapper site is basically a static site. I'm reading MDM markdown files and loading them up inside of a Svelte site. So my site is really not complex at all. My Sapper site, I'm not going to be doing anything with it until SvelteKit is done and released and out of the way and whatever. I have been familiarizing myself with the technologies. On the production builds and everything, they're going to be using Rollup. And then on the front-end client side for development, they're going to be using Snowpack. Now, we had Fred on the show talking about Skypack and PikaPack and some of the projects he was working on. And Snowpack is the sort of current iteration of all that stuff. And Snowpack is really super cool if you haven't checked it out. Snowpack.dev. One of the coolest things about Snowpack is just how insanely fast it is. They're touting 50 millisecond build times, or just outrageous stuff. Because what's happening is they're just loading up a file, and if it needs compilation, then they're compiling that single file rather than your entire project. So build times are just effortlessly tiny and short. I've been running experimentally Snowpack on a Level Up Tutorials branch to try to see if we can have our site. We do a lot of like cute things with our repo that are kind of getting in the way. But when I got it working at least a little bit, oh boy, howdy, it was really cool. So I'm going to sit and wait a little bit. I'm really, really excited that they're choosing to do this route with Rollup and Snowpack, both separately for production or development bundles. I'd like to do something similar for us at some point in the future. But yeah, I feel really, really strongly positively about this. I think it's neat. Okay, so now we have a bunch of WordPress questions. We might be able to breeze through some of these because a lot of them are pretty similar. WordPress questions. First one is from Jesse Woody. I'm currently working through a full stack Udemy course to make the switch away from my day job to a freelance web development. I want to start taking on some easier freelance jobs to make extra money for my portfolio. And I see WordPress as a recommended way to do this. My basic question is, would it be worth undertaking the learning process of picking up some PHP to learn basic WordPress development so that I can start freelancing now? Or would I be better served learning HTML, CSS, and JavaScript and waiting to broaden my understanding of these languages before taking on clients?
That's a great question. Like, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, would WordPress still be the best intro to building freelance websites? Before you all get angry because you all hate WordPress, there's some things to think about. Like, why do freelancers pick WordPress a lot of the times? And it's because it's quick to get up and running. It's super cheap to host. The plugin ecosystem is massive. The client comes to you and says, hey, I need the website to do this. There is almost always a plugin that will do something similar to that. And that's huge because a lot of freelance developers either don't have the time or the skill to build that thing themselves. Even if we're looking at like your headless CMS, there's not plugins. Like Gatsby has plugins, things like that, but they don't have the whole admin backend UI plugins that would be able to do that. And often the alternative to using a plugin is pay this $8 a month for this service, which is often not an option. So if you're looking at building a couple $1,000 websites for clients, is it worth learning PHP and picking up some WordPress? I'm going to say, yeah. Why? Because learning how to like how much PHP do you really need to know in order to do WordPress? Not a whole lot. You need to know how to build classes and extend things. No, you need to know how to like make a variable, loop over things, create a function that takes in data and returns stuff. And all of the stuff that you learn in JavaScript can also apply to WordPress. So if that's the route you want to go, I think that's a pretty good route. If you want, you could also go the route of just doubling down on JavaScript and becoming more of a JavaScript dev and like a freelance where people will hire you to build UI kits and components and things like that. And you can get pretty far with just JavaScript, but there's still just so much. So like I have a lot of freelance devs friends myself, but I think I've seen a lot of like big businesses, what do you call them? Agencies either closed down that were doing like full-time WordPress. Not all of them. There's lots of agencies out there that do big WordPress stuff still, but I've seen a lot of them go away, but there still is a lot of freelance WordPress devs that WordPress is their choice. So yeah, I would say like, it's probably don't bet on, I'm always hesitant with this stuff because everybody hates WordPress. And I always feel like I have to like defend it to everybody. But like, I still think it is currently like, I've got my qualms about it, but I think it still is a really good choice for that type of thing.
I think you have to decide like essentially what type of developer you're wanting to be, because, you know, if you want to be working at like Fang and doing maybe like engineering or computer science stuff, or maybe even more advanced user interfaces, then you're probably going to get more bang for your buck out of going hard on JavaScript. But if you just want to build client sites, and if you want to build client sites in like an agency world or anything like that, learning PHP and WordPress overall will be very helpful for you in the long run. It's not going to be going anywhere anytime soon. So yeah, I would say it just all depends on what your goals are there. Next question is from Eric Butler. If I plan to use WordPress as a headless CMS, how do I make sure the WordPress site itself is not publicly accessible? As far as I know, there's no API-only mode for WordPress like there is for Rails or Laravel. And if I install a WordPress site on a server and it's going to be discoverable online, I'd hate to have people in the WordPress API site think it was my website, or for my static site to have to compete with my WordPress API for prominence in search engines. How do I ensure this won't happen? Redirects robots only have that HTTP/API or whatever the word was, a WP-API, or I forget what it is even.
He means the REST endpoint of the URL.
Correct. Yeah. So either way, having the REST endpoint of your API, or use a GraphQL where there's only the one endpoint, have those be publicly accessible. And as far as your WordPress site goes, redirects, like I said, redirects and robots to prevent it from being crawled. So robots file disallow crawlers, and then redirect especially the homepage to your other actual homepage.
Yeah, there's likely a plugin that will do this for you. But if it was me, what would I do? I would make a WordPress theme called WP-nothing. I would have an index.php in there, because the way WordPress works is that everything will eventually try the index.php if it doesn't find any other files. And you just type in PHP return. You return nothing, blank. And then, okay, that's done. There's no front end to your website. And then just to be doubly safe, just like Scott says, robots.txt, disallow star, everything. And that would be good, I think.
One time we had our staging environment competing with the client's actual site because we forgot to do our robots on it.
You know what? I think the Syntax website needs to do that right now, because I was thinking like all these Netlify and Vercel deployment previews.
Oh, deployment.
Because those are URLs out in the wild. I'm like, does that automatically...
I wonder if they automatically do that.
Canonically link back?
Huh.
Do we need to add like a robots.txt dependent on environmental variables?
Interesting.
Probably need to, yeah. But like, I also would assume that Google would put something into their search engine to make sure, like, clearly it's the same website and these things keep popping up and all the links go back to syntax.fm, but we should probably look into that.
Yeah. Next question is from Gage. Sorry, I'm going to rapid fire some of these out here. If I have a Vue.js website running on WordPress, how could I dynamically insert Vue components into the Word or from the WordPress backend? E.g., have every post that inserts a Vue.js pull component. I don't want to recompile. So that... this is a tough one, because what? The component has to be living in PHP, essentially, if you're inserting a chunk of code, and that chunk of code could be written once, and that code is hitting the back end. So probably what would have to happen, this is me spitballing because I've never done this, but you probably have to, what, compile that code down to just straight up JavaScript, insert that JavaScript to be loaded via a WordPress widget or WordPress section or something, and then just have some parameters being able to be changed. I don't know how the two interact. This sounds like a tough one to me. And I always remember back in the day of working in Drupal, and there was these things called Drupal blocks. And there was this experimental way that you could turn on PHP in the Drupal blocks. And everyone who was like good at Drupal would be like, please just don't do this, because you're essentially typing PHP into a text area on the site. And I think about how many times I was like, well, this would be a lot easier if I just copy and pasted this PHP into this text area. It almost always worked, but it never felt great. So I don't know. This seems pretty sketch to me, but it seems like something you could probably pull off. Wes, any thoughts here?
Like, you could just dynamically insert it via the React DOM.render or Vue.js DOM.render, and then pass in the data via props into that component. So unless I'm like listening to this or understanding this incorrectly, there's probably something wrong with the way that you're architecting your component if you need to recompile it based on different data that needs to be passed in, because that's the beauty of the components, right? One quick thing from the last question. I just looked it up, and both Vercel and Netlify will send a header called X robots tag, and they will disallow your preview URLs from being indexed by Google. So you don't even have to do anything there. It will automatically happen.
Oh, cool.
Next question from Glenn. My question has to do with WordPress. I've heard you mention previously that you have used WordPress to host sites in the past. I'm keen to learn how you have created your own themes for those sites. Do you write your own PHP, et cetera, or is there another way? I'm hoping to learn a bit more about developing for WordPress. This is a skill I'd like to have in my back pocket. Love to hear about any resources you'd recommend for this. This is a good question. So there's sort of like, I don't know, three different ways that you can approach this. There's one type of person will go and buy a theme and then just start tweaking it to make it look like they want. So that's a pretty popular thing to do. You're like, okay, I want to make this website. I'll start with something close enough and we'll tweak it until it is. Another type of person will buy a theme and they'll create a child theme, which allows you to selectively overwrite parts of a specific theme. And that's great because if this is like this weird thing in WordPress where themes also come with a bunch of functionality, which should be a plugin, but the theme does come with all this functionality and the theme needs to be updated to support new things. And themes have become massive and just they're almost a CMS in themselves. It's kind of important if you're doing that, then you need to maintain the code base and then just apply your stuff on top of it. That's a child theme. What I do is just, I had like a starter theme that I built, but it's all just totally from scratch. It had like your basic loops, your basic nav, your basic footer, all of that stuff in it. And I would just start from that and then build out the site from there. And I wouldn't update the starter because it basically just, it's just like a little bit of starter code. And it's not something you have to update over time. So yeah, did I write all the PHP myself? Absolutely. I still have a handful of WordPress websites that I maintain. My own wife's website is still in WordPress. And all of that is just custom written PHP that I've done myself, along with the handful of plugins for functionality that is needed.
Cool. Yeah, I honestly have not written PHP or WordPress in a while. So I'm going to defer to you on that one. I think the child themes or having a starter theme is, of course, the way to go. And if you are hacking a theme, you best have some sort of error handling and exception tracking because, well, if you're hacking a theme too much, maybe you have broken something. And it would be nice to know if you broke something. So I'm going to recommend Sentry at sentry.io. Imagine that. One of our favorite sponsors over here at Syntax. So you'll want to check out Sentry, sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word. You're going to get 2 months for free. And I am just a huge fan of Sentry. We use it all the time. And one of the things I mentioned here on the show about how much I like it is really just the fact that every time I go to Sentry, I feel like there's new stuff. You know, Sentry's been a big player in the industry for a while now, and I don't feel like they're not resting on their laurels. Is that a saying? Either way, they're not taking it easy here. They're always adding new features and functionalities to Sentry, even little tweaks and enhancements to the interface. So if you want the best error exceptionally handling service out there, check out Sentry at sentry.io. Coupon code TASTYTREAT, 2 months for free. Okay, let's get into the last couple of questions here. We have some career questions, and then I think we can wrap it up with these two last questions here. This first one is from Tim. Hello. It says, I've been a developer for 15 years. Unfortunately, I've had to leave web development for personal reasons. I have a lot of great skills. Unfortunately, because I've been out of the game for so long, my resume is full of holes. All of the current experience I have is project-based or freelance-based. I do not have the ability to show long-term projects or anything stable on my resume. I'm trying to get my first job back into the field after a long absence, and it's proven difficult to nearly impossible. I'm listening to your Tasty Treat about certifications and certified education. I agree that certifications do not show actual skill. I also agree that just because I do not have longevity and consistency on my resume, that I do not have the skills to pay the bills. That's right, Tim. I like that confidence. How can I get my first job back in the field? I am working on small projects to highlight my skill, but no one really seems to care. What would you do? Yeah, this one's tough. You really just need to find that agency, that dev shop, whatever, those developers who will see through the BS that this industry has in it sometimes and gives you a chance. Because I think back to my first, I know you've been a dev for 15 years. So my first hire as a dev, I got hired largely because I think the developer, you know, knew I maybe wasn't there, but could tell I was passionate about what I was doing. I really loved it. And I was always trying to strive to better myself. And I think those kind of qualities that interviewers sometimes neglect can be the qualities that make you the best hire. So you're going to want to apply for a lot of things, obviously. You're going to want to interview for a lot of things. So you're going to want to play a bit of a numbers game here. And I don't know if I would go too heavy into the, like, I don't want to say fang, but like you might be better off looking at like agency places because they might be more likely to hire somebody who's not like straight out of the boot camp, slinging algorithm answers like they just practice them via flashcards or something like that. They might be looking for somebody who has a more breadth of experience. So I would definitely say approach that world or the agency world type of things, or find maybe a small project to help out on open source code, things like that, that will look good on a resume. Obviously, nobody has infinite time, so it's like impossible to just say, oh, go off and hack away on some open source projects and whatever and just come back and get a job. So as long as you are passionate, you're applying, you're improving your skills, somebody will take a chance on you. You just got to keep going for it.
Yeah, that's kind of the interesting thing about like somebody who's been at it for 15 years, your problem solving skills are amazing. And no matter how much time you've taken off, your problem solving skills are probably very good. People skills, I'm assuming, are good. If you've been a web developer for 15 years, you've probably dealt with some clients over the years and things like that. So it's hard to say without actually seeing your resume and whatnot, like what the actual problem would be. But what I would do is like, you just need to present yourself as having all of these skills in addition to the latest hotness that everybody wants, right? Like, yeah, you should probably show that you're good with JavaScript and can sling a serverless function and can connect to a database and things like that. But also on the flip side, you have problem solving skills and people skills. So how do you do that? Well, you say you're highlighting your skills with small projects. Maybe you need to jump onto some like open source and say, hey, I'm a maintainer on X, Y, and Z. Attach yourself to some maybe larger projects. Or like, I'm surprised he's saying that the people don't seem to care about the small projects, because that's what everybody said when we asked about certifications. The proof is in the pudding, right? So maybe those projects need a little bit more. Like, it's not just like a 1 or 2 day thing, but you spend a couple of weeks on building these types of things. So also, what would I do? Blog posts, maybe YouTube videos.
Oh yeah.
Conference talks, things like that. Taking the topics that I talked about, like problem solving, people skills, whatever other skills you think you have from your 15 years, write a blog post about how you think new developers can apply those things and just kind of show off and flex the fact that you do have these things. And especially like a conference talk, right now all the conferences are online and there's tons of them. Like, there's probably like 3 times the amount of conferences than there were before, because you can do them online and everybody's trying to do an online conference. So you can probably do either a YouTube video, a conference talk, blog post about those skills. So that's what I would probably try next. But I also think like we need to do some sort of episode on like reviewing people's resume I don't know what you call that, but like your presence, you know, like people often say like, hey, I've done these things, but it's not working. Why? We don't really see much past these questions. So I'd love to be like, all right, well, I looked at your website and
these are the first things I noticed. Yeah.
Yeah. Something as simple as you have way too much drop shadow on this thing. That's a huge turnoff for me, you know? And just like little things like that could be doing
obvious it. Bad fonts or something.
Yeah. 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 Totally. And those are things like if you've got 100 people to look at and somebody's gone overboard with a drop shadow, seems petty, but I would be like, next. They clearly don't care about that type of thing, where you might not even think about that. You're like, oh, it looks fine to me. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
Last question from Ethan. Hey, Wes and Scott, I'm currently in a food service job, but would love to move into the dev and design field. I have a year of experience in JavaScript, HTML, CSS, and SAS, as well as React, Gatsby, Next, and Node. Okay, bingo. This guy has hit all of the the bingo spots for it. I have a small amount of experience with freelance web design and development, but I feel like I am greatly underselling myself $150 for a Gatsby site built for a friend and less than $100 for a couple of Fiverr gigs. Yeah, that's very cheap. I have seen freelance work out well for my friends and family, but I'm terrified of having to find clients. I have a hard time valuing my work and fold when money is brought up. There is always a part of me that just says shoot high and have them talk the price down, but I hate confrontation. How should I go about finding my first $1,000 client, and how should I show the client that my work is worth it? This is a great question, because we have a couple freelancing episodes you can go to, and we have a couple on quoting as well. Go through and listen to all of those, because it is a hard thing to say, this is my work, allow me to bill you. Like $1,000 is not even a lot for a website, but a lot of people are super uncomfortable with even asking that, because there's maybe some imposter syndrome there. They don't feel that their skills are worth it. It really just boils down to not proving to the client that you are worth that, but proving to the client that the tech you are building is going to be worth it to them, to their business, or to their organization. So you're building a new website for a realtor. If you literally get one new client from this website, like I remember when we bought our house, I went through like 15 different realtor websites, and there was one person that had a nice website, and we went with them.
That sounds very you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you paid a couple thousand bucks to have a nicely designed website, and you got, I don't know, how much do realtors make? Tons from selling a house.
Right.
Right. So you just have to like sort of turn the tables and say, it's going to be worth it to your business to spend this stuff. And also like you just, the first time putting yourself out there, you just got to put them, you got to put the quote forward and say, this is what I'll charge. I'm really excited to help your business succeed. That's it. And don't stop saying sorry and I'm not sure. And if it's too much, let me know. You just got to put it out there, and they might walk away because it's not what they expected. But like from what you're saying, people should be jumping at $1,000 websites from you.
Yeah. And just think about, we did a lot of comparing to other industries in those episodes. And I do want you to think about that when you're thinking about this as well, because think about the last tradesperson that you hired who, you know, I don't know, I've had people into like, look at our bathroom or something, because we need a little bit of a reno on our bathroom, right? So we had several people right before the pandemic come over and look at it. And sure enough, COVID hit and we didn't get to do it. But I remember the process that I went through in my brain trying to decide which of these people would be the right people to go with. And I'm thinking just like how they talked about their work. And it's difficult to ask for money and be confident about all that stuff when you do feel maybe a little bit of impostery or you're not used to it. But just think about those tradespeople who are like, it's going to be this much, take it or leave it, I do good work. And that's really like kind of the mindset you need to be in a way. It's like, this is definitely going to be worth it to your client. It shouldn't be, you shouldn't work to undervalue it. There's a book called Design is a Job. I talk about at least a few times a month on this podcast by Mike Monterio that is really good about hyping you up to believe that your work is worth way more than you're asking for. And I highly recommend checking that book out, because it can really change your mindset. But again, think about other tradespeople. And if you were hiring somebody, what type of qualities would you like to see in that person? And try to emulate a lot of those things. Just try to, you know, even you can pretend or LARP around like you are a really fancy, you know, boutique website guy. And maybe that's it. But yeah, I think that will go a long ways for you.
Yeah, like even just one more thing, going back to that, like Scott said about the having a contractor or a trade in your house. It's always like a mix of like, clearly you're competent enough to do this, but I also like you as a people person.
I trust you
to be able to say like, oh yeah, it's going to look amazing in here. Like, oh, you know what we did on another website is we made it responsive and we did like a different nav. So like, you've got a lot of items in your nav. And I think that we could like rearrange this thing on mobile. So it works a little bit nicer. And then you say, hey, have you ever been on a website where it's just like awful to use on your phone? Just like relate to them a little bit and say like, yeah, we can make this work together. Awesome. It's not just like, I charge $1,000. Yes or no. You know, like there's a lot you can do in terms of like putting your client at ease and getting them excited for the work that you're going to do. So good luck with that. That sounds really cool.
Heck yes. That is it for this potluck. I think it's time to get into sick picks. Sick picks are things that we pick that are, we find to be sick. Wes, do you have any sick picks? Because I at least have a few. I've been podcast hunting lately.
Oh, man. Good. You got even more podcasts. I am going to sick pick a box of meat.
See, this is very on brand. I'm sick picking a podcast, which is going to be some sort of a scam-based crime podcast. And you are going to sick pick a box of meat. This is very on brand.
Yes, very on brand. So I tried out one of these local box of meat delivery companies. It's called True Local. This is probably for Canadians, most likely. I think they're in Ontario, and check if they're in your location as well. I'm in Ontario. And it's really cool because there's a lot of farms in Ontario that do good quality, sustainably sourced. They're kind to the cows and pigs and things like that. And then there's also like you going to the grocery store, and there's a bit of a disconnect between like being able to just buy it directly from your farmer, and then the stuff that's in the grocery store is not necessarily some of the best stuff. So I tried out one of these boxes from True Local, and it was awesome. I got bacon, bone broth, bunch of steaks, really nice prime rib, turkey bacon, which was surprisingly good. And it was really cool. You can sign up, you fill out your box. They give you like 20 points, and like bacon is 1 point. And then like a prime rib is 4 or 5 points, something like that. And it was really cool. Big fan.
That sounds cool.
So check it out. It's True Local, TRULocal.ca. And you can just sign up for 1 month and try it out. It comes with dry ice, which is really cool because have you ever had dry ice, Scott?
Hey, True Local USA. Man, we've ordered some food before that has come with dry ice as well.
But yeah, it comes with dry ice, which I was very surprised because it went out for delivery at like 8 a.m. and I got it at like 3 p.m. and everything was rock hard still. And then we put all the dry ice in a bunch of like boiling water, and our entire kitchen was full of all the steam, and the kids loved it. So it was great. fun for the whole family.
Yeah. I should check this out. I know we've been doing some of those meal delivery services. You know, we've tried all of them out because that's what Courtney does. She does like the coupon that you get for the first month of them. And since there's like 20 of them, she's just like tried all of them. So meat delivery looks cool. I'm into it. My sick pick is, I got to pick a podcast here. I've had so many interesting podcasts that I've been listening to. I could really just close my eyes and pick at some of these interesting ones I've been listening to. But I think this one might be the most entertaining and something I never heard of. It's called Chameleon Hollywood Con Queen. Con, a swindling type of podcast of which I am into.
Ooh.
This one is really wild. It's a story about tradespeople in Hollywood being essentially scammed into this really bizarre scam where they're flown to Jakarta and then sort of driven around and they're depositing small amounts of money here and there. It is so weird. But by episode 6, I've already had several like what moments, and I can't believe I've never heard of this at all. So Chameleon Hollywood Con Queen, it's very good. The storytelling is very good. You know, it's your standard, you know, 45-minute long true crime episode where it's like, you know, each one reveals a little bit more like a Netflix documentary or something. But I really like this one, and it just popped up on my radar, and I've been just constantly being like, whoa. Hey, actually, let me do a twofer here because podcasts are a dime a dozen, right? Here's a twofer. The second one here is, this is an iHeartRadio podcast, and it is called Q Clearance, The Hunt for QAnon. If you aren't familiar with the QAnon conspiracy, it's like...
You a Q head, Scott?
Oh, God. Come on, Wes, please. it's so stupid. It's so incredibly stupid. And what this podcast is doing is it's this guy who's British, so he's got like no dog in the fight here, so to say. But he's like just trying to identify who the heck Q is as a person, maybe diving into the history of a lot of the anonymous image boards and message boards on the internet, and like talking about the likelihood of the fact that it's it was most likely one person pulling a prank on other people and then like now has been in the ownership of an actual white supremacist guy who is just like doing it to rile up the base. It is a very interesting, and he does a lot of diving into internet stuff. So if you're like a Darknet Diaries fan, Q Clearance is very good. It's very, very good. It's also horrifying just how many people believe such an idiotic thing in general. So yeah, those are my two picks.
Beautiful. All right. Shamelessly plug all of my courses, westboss.com/courses. Check it out and learn a thing or two for the upcoming 2021.
Yeah. Check out leveluptutorials.com, our latest course. At the time of recording this episode is Dino 101 for web developers. We teach you the basics of working in Dino. By the end of this course, you get up and running, being able to read file. We do a contract generator where you read a file and you enter some inputs and it spits you out a contract. We also work pretty heavily in Oak, which is a Koa-like web framework for Dino, where we build into actually building an API with Oak. We get into serving static files and static pages with Oak and a lot of neat stuff along the way. So if you want to, as a web developer, learn the very basics of Dino, check out Dino 101 for web developers on leveluptutorials.com.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you on Monday. And Merry Christmas.
And happy holidays to all of those who don't celebrate Christmas as well, Wes, you inconsiderate fool.
Happy holidays, everybody. Sorry. Yes.
Peace. Peace and love. Peace and love. And sleigh bells.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.